similar state. Others were able to send a messenger to gallop back to the palace for help. The council sent out 6 of their best men and a wagon through the rutted, frost-covered roads to rescue the young princess. As the men loaded her onto the cart, however, one of them grew weary and hardly made it out of the woods before falling to the ground in an unshakable sleep. The others hurried on their course, wrapping the princess in thick cloaks. But on the short ride back to the palace, the remaining councilman, too, succumbed. So the tale goes, the horse driver hardly made it past the chains of the drawbridge glimmering in the morning sun before he fell asleep on his perch. The horse, confused, whinnied and tried to bolt, yanking the cart the rest of the way into the palace, where the strange contagion continued to spread. There has been no movement since, no message, no wave of a flag from within those walls to signify life. All roads of the palace have been cordoned off. Strange stories, Claudine thinks. Fairy curses. She'd be amazed if any of the fae still have the power they once did. These days, a fairy curse carries hardly more magic than it takes to boil a kettle, and yet the unlikeliness of the princess finding that particular abandoned cottage, it reeks of fairy magic. "A sleeping sickness," she says now to her maid. "It reminds me of something my cousin Violet once said. At the child's christening." "The child?" the maid asks timidly. "The princess, of course," Claudine says. "Now leave me." She lumbers out of her bed, humming to herself in a voice far purer than should belong to someone of her age. She waddles to the window, throwing open the sash and shutters and breathing in the harsh air. It is winter outside, and it is winter too, always within her. Nothing can fill the void. Nothing satisfies the hunger. Nothing can take root, no matter how much sweetness she consumes. Except something has taken root. For even now a thick, dark-vined briar pushes its way out of the hard, frozen dirt surrounding the cottage where Aurora was found. Thorns splinter along its stems as it grows eagerly, with a hunger as powerful as Claudine's own, stretching along the path through the royal forest, reaching the road, and eventually winding toward the palace itself, thickening as it grows long, doubling, tripling, quadrupling, pressing onward, blossoming with purple-white buds, and rising, rising, rising. 14. Isabel. Timing is everything. One might even say it was bad timing that Isby was born in the same year the king decided to banish all of his mistresses from the land, ensuring the new queen would never be made jealous, and that Isby would never know her own mother. And because she understands how crucial timing can be, Isby is not surprised to hear her spear whiz a few feet into the air before splashing uselessly into the sea, missing the rope entirely. Her palm stings, her skin's raw, her pulse loud in her ears. Throughout the din of the hunt, she had been listening carefully to the high, faint whine of the harpoon's rope as it pulled taut. It was the sound of fraying, of fibers untwining and splitting. She had tried to point her spear not at the whale but directly at that sound. Even though she missed, she was right about one thing. There's a terrible wrenching sound as the narwhal gives a final, angry heave, and the rope snaps. A tiny spark of hope lights in Isby's heart, even as her body is thrown backward from the aftershock and the icy waves envelop her. The whale has gotten free. She thrashes, as the beast had done. She tries to scream underwater. She burns from the inside. Her body struggles for many minutes, and then begins to let go, to soften. Her mind follows, turning numb. From that numbness, a faint pressure emerges, a pattern against her open hands. It's a message. The sea is speaking to her in the same way Aurora does, by tapping in their secret language. Or maybe it isn't the sea, but Aurora herself, or a memory of Aurora. "I'm afraid," the water pulses into her hand. "I need you." The tapping becomes angry, nonsensical, frantic. It is no longer a message. It is wood, the end of a stray oar. Isby grasps for it, but it eludes her. She tries again, her mind beginning to awaken. The desire to live shoots through her with the power of cannon fire, and she grabs again, holding on as the slippery oar yanks her upward toward the surface, and her face breaks free. She gags on salt water as air whooshes into her lungs. Someone is pulling the other end of the oar. Someone has saved her. Part 3. The Shadow and the Child. 15. Aurora. Night is a gasp, and then over. Opening her eyes, Aurora needs no gauzy sway of a curtain to signal the wind's presence. The unseen forces of the world all have bodies she understands now. Phantoms fill the air. A soft moan comes from her throat. The pain in her ankle has subsided into a distant throb. Yet the bed, the sheets, the weight of the blanket over her, the tickle of fresh breeze across her brow, these gather into a complex melody that makes her want. More and more every day. She's not even sure what she wants, but she knows that obedience, grace, kindness, these no longer form the only standards by which she can live. Not with this new, lush thing born inside her. Desire, for touch, for the breath that inflates her chest, for her voice, for life, the feeling of it. She sits up, letting memory slowly sift back into her like flower through a sieve. She had tried to keep track of the days at first, but Samae has a way of blurring things together. Time seems to glide by almost invisibly, like a skitterbug across a lake. How long has she been gone? Sleepily, she lists the facts to herself. Deluce needs her. She must return, marry a prince, and protect her kingdom. Though these things have begun to seem like mere strands of a book she once read, the one that stands out the most is this. She has to get back to Isby, which means somehow finding a way out of this place. Aurora's stomach stirs. She flips back the covers and dresses quickly, with ever-increasing confidence. Even hunger has a different and greater impact here. In Deluce, she'd often go hours forgetting to eat, especially when caught up in a good book. But here she feels the pang and immediately begins to imagine the juice of a fresh peach, the smooth spread of butter on warm pastries, even though she knows they don't have such luxuries. In Deluce, servants brought breakfast to her room, and Isby always joined her before they started their day. But everything is different in Samae. She eats with the others, her rank doesn't matter, and her sister isn't here. Isby ran away, a voice reminds Aurora as she slips on her boots. She was content to live without you. She loved you, but she pitied you. She has once again kicked the wasp's nest of thoughts that always lie just to the side of her path. Her heart races as she tries to ignore her doubts. She glances out the window. From the tower, Aurora can see all the way across the desiccated fields surrounding Blackthorn, butting up against a thick, dry forest. There's no sign of the stone wall from here, the one that protects the estate from the borderlands, the one she and Heath unbelievably pass through together. Below her, there are already peasants up early, moving about near a run-down barn, and in the distance, a figure approaches the woods alone. Heath, going off to hunt once again, in the borderlands. Over the past few days, she has watched him return home dragging the bodies of whole harts and wild boar with arrows aslant in their chests, sacks filled with bloody pheasant and duck parts, and once a net of fish, some still writhing. And she has watched too as Wren greets him each time with something more than gratitude in her posture, in her smile. "You'll only break his heart," Wren had said to her on that first day. Many nights he goes straight to his chambers without eating dinner, hunched over a lantern, making notes to himself. At first she was impressed that he could read and write, though only rudimentarily. And then she became curious. He explained that he was keeping a hunting log because game has grown increasingly scarce. With everything she learns about Samae, Aurora has only become more concerned for its fate, has come to realize that escape may be necessary not just for her or for Heath, but for all of them. But in the meantime, she has been trying to help however she can. Here there's no complex hierarchy of household staff to run the palace and maintain its grounds and outbuildings. Instead, chores are assigned based on family, with many peasants who don't appear to have any role at all. Greta and her family man the kitchens along with several others, and though Aurora has no experience, she's made herself useful there, hanging herbs to dry, grinding grain into powder to make flour, scrubbing vegetables from the gardens until her hands, usually prized for their daintiness, have grown ragged and chapped. This may be a world wrought from dreaming, but for Aurora, it has provided her first taste of real work and real life. Life the way the masses live it, both here and, she can only assume, at home. She doesn't bother to pin up her hair. She grabs a piece of vellum that she'd asked Wren to procure yesterday and flings open her bedroom door, runs down the stairs and out onto the grounds, making her way after Heath. She inhales the morning dew as she calls out to him repeatedly, but he doesn't turn around. Aurora's beginning to fear her voice has somehow been imagined this whole time, both by her and by others, when finally he hears her and turns. "What are you doing out here?" he asks, sweeping her out of his eyes. She's noticed how often he does that around her, and she wonders fleetingly if she makes him nervous. She tries to catch her breath. "I thought I could come with you today. Help take notes for you. I'm a very skilled writer, and I have excellent penmanship. I..."
"Aurora, it isn't safe. You need to go back."
"But I want to be of use. Every day I've been biding my time, wandering alone, and I haven't gotten any closer to an answer."
Her limited contributions leave plenty of time to roam the castle, looking for evidence, for a sign, for a way out, as though she might simply stumble upon a lost key to a hidden door. Maybe, she has thought irrationally, she'd find another spinning wheel. But she has not, and her own sense of urgency has already begun to wane. Isby comes to her as a sharp pang of need, but then fades from her mind again. Samay itself has this effect on her. There's a poignancy to every breath here, and it distracts her, reminds her of early mornings when she was 11 or 12, just discovering the tomes of epic romance in the library. How she'd take her latest treasure down to the kitchens, where she'd sit in a window to read while the warm scent of baking biscuits drifted and curled around her, steaming the pane. Samay gives her that exact feeling, those brief hours when you are holding an unread story in your hands and don't yet know how it will end. You would be content if the biscuits never rose and were never consumed. The irises in the garden never bloomed and faded. The rain hovered but never fell. The not-yetness tastes sweeter than the thing you're waiting for.
"I thought I could help you. At least I could get out of the estate and..."
"And get yourself killed in the borderlands," Heath sighs, his arm muscles flexing as if by instinct. "I can see you are beginning to feel what this place does to people. That restlessness, half sweet, half deadly. You don't need to get lost or be lured by an impression to go mad here. Sometimes it happens all on its own."
"But you've been ignoring me. Avoiding me, even," she adds, realizing that it's true. "We agreed to help each other find a way out of Samay. I thought..."
"I made you no promises."
"But you did," she insists, feeling baffled and dismayed by the way he won't even look in her eyes.
"I said I would protect you, and that's what I'm trying to do right now. As for a way out, I had hoped you might have answers, but you don't. In the meantime, Blackthorn needs me."
His hands clench and unclench.
"But the game dwindles," she counters. "You can't just turn back to your life, knowing one day the food may run out completely."
The heat of their argument is warming her cheeks.
"What do you know about hunger? You grew up a sheltered, spoiled princess."
The accusation stings, even though it shouldn't. Her royal upbringing shouldn't be an insult.
"I didn't choose my own parents."
"No, but they chose everything for you," he snaps.
"What does that mean?"
"It means now that I've thought more about the corruption of your world, the way human senses are bartered out of vanity, I'm less convinced I want anything to do with it."
Aurora's jaw drops. He can't mean that. He is just lashing out because of his disappointment.
his disappointment in her. Shame roils in her gut. She draws in a breath, trying not to stare at Heath's mouth, trying not to imagine, as she has done every night in her bed, him touching her face tenderly again, the way he did on the first night. "Fine," she says. "You can stay here and hunt until there's not a single deer left in the forest. I'm going to find my own way home." She marches off, an unfamiliar emotion sparking and raging in her throat. Anger. Back inside the castle, she finds her way to the study where she has seen Heath retire to make his notes. He doesn't think she knows what it's really like to be one of them. Well, why should she? No one's told her, no one's given her a chance to understand. Pushing her way into the small space, she sees piles of empty, dirty cups, indicating he has stayed up late many nights, working and thinking. At the desk beneath the window lies a stack of pages. She sits down to rifle through them, except they aren't notes, really. They're more like charts and graphs with all sorts of scrawled labels. Depictions, she realizes slowly, of the borderlands. He's been keeping track of its patterns, how it changes. He must think that by decoding how their world operates, he will find a secret loophole, and with it, an exit. But how many years has he spent on this project with no success? Aurora touches the pages. It strikes her that perhaps Heath is missing the point. What if there simply is no exit? The prick of the spinning wheel's flying bobbin sent her here, or so she has gathered. It's possible the spinning wheel has some significance, but does it really represent a pattern? Or is it just a disconnected clue? Why, in a world built from the power of dreaming, would anything follow logic? She drops the vellum and leaves his study. Everyone has warned her repeatedly to stay away from the north turret. It's dangerous to get too close to the Queen's quarters, they say. But what good has cowering done them, or anyone, for that matter? She moves through parlour room after parlour room, trying to avoid those peasants who don't work, the ones who huddle in corners with dark looks. They unsettle her. Hunger seems to have hardened in them like tree sap. She could almost see a bitterness crystallizing in the whites of their eyes, the way frost solidifies over a leaf in winter. She has a sense that if she stares too long, she too will succumb and freeze. She clenches her stomach and forges past them. The must and mildew of the back halls fill her lungs as she makes her way toward the forbidden wing. Finally, after several twists and turns, she reaches the locked door at the end of the long and narrow north hall. Aurora balls up her fists and bangs on the door. She bangs and bangs, but nothing happens. The harder she pounds on the echoing wood, the more her frustration mounts. How dare Heath accuse her of being sheltered and spoiled when she's done nothing but tried to help? If she's honest with herself, the insult has wounded her for a deeper reason. She is not only an outsider to him, but someone with qualities he doesn't admire. Wealth, privilege, innocence. Qualities she'd thought made her special. He believes that her father and mother were self-serving, cynical, greedy, that they allowed her to be deprived of touch and voice for their own benefit instead of for hers. But that's not true. It can't be, can it? Even as she wonders about these things, her past begins to unfold before her in a new light, and it makes her feel sick. Maybe Heath is right. She thinks of the way her mother treated Isby, as though she was not a family member at all. Maybe her parents were cruel. She sinks to the floor beside the locked door and pulls out the necklace she's been carrying around, the one she found in the hearth on her first night. A bead is missing. Why is the bead missing? And why does this detail bother her so? She has the sudden, desperate conviction that if she can fix this necklace, she can still save some final piece of her childhood. But it's all so disgustingly obvious, isn't it? Aurora has been a pawn. She has been used. She has meant nothing to anyone, except as a figurehead. She thought, like Umberline, that she wanted to be freed from stone, that she wanted to speak and to feel. But now she's afraid of all the bad things she might feel, is already feeling, of all the things she might say. She can hurt people now, and be hurt by them, in all new ways. But what really hurts is seeing that her life until now was a lie. The only one who even cared about Aurora, not as a princess, but as a person, was Isby. She fumbles with the jewels in her hand. A tear streaks her face. She wipes it away, and another pearl comes loose from the strand. The pearl rolls away from her and under the locked door. Slowly, the door opens. Aurora scrambles back to her feet, and then, with caution, she glances around her before approaching the doorway. Almost despite herself, she walks through it. She enters an enormous, windowless hall lined with cobwebs, and she squints to see beautiful, plentiful tapestries. There are so many they overlap on the walls. Some are coated in a thick layer of dust, others seem freshly hung. The night fairies work. She shivers. But no one is in here, so how did the door open on its own? Aurora can hear the tiny rattle of the rolling pearl, though she can't see it in the dim-lit room. Her footsteps click faintly, as though the sound has come from a distance. The air is dense and stifling, and the weak light from the open door behind her only serves to highlight the dust motes in the air, making it even harder to see. Though she's been exposed to plenty of artwork before, Aurora is awed as she moves closer to the tapestries. They are especially elaborate, each depicting a landscape with immaculate detail. And she pauses, taking them in individually in the near darkness of the room. There's something about each that she recognizes. They must be based on the Queen's memories from the real world. It occurs to her that all of Somei has been constructed out of the Queen's memories of the real world. Warped, dreamlike versions of real things. Blackthorn, the Royal Forest. She wonders what other pieces of her world have a double here. She has the sensation of moving through water, a murky, reedy lake, as she walks farther into the room. She comes to a portrayal, this one newer, less dusty, of the cottage in the borderlands. And within the window, a table set with tea still steaming. The image, eerily familiar, sends a chill through her. It's as though the silk itself wavers like steam. As though Belle Kerr purposely wove the steam over the tea so it would still be hot when Aurora arrived. Like she knew someone was coming. Aurora had forgotten about the rattling sound until now. Abruptly, it stops. She turns. At the far end of the hall, someone has bent down to pick up the pearl. Someone with long, disheveled white hair and a large crown. The old woman, the queen, Aurora realizes with a quick intake of breath, continues turning the bead over in her fingers with apparent consternation, like she's trying to recall something. Then the queen looks up. Aurora freezes, terrified. Her instinct is to run, but she can only stare. The woman was obviously once beautiful, but now old. Thick makeup streaks her face with a jester-like horror, as though applied by a child's hand. Her crown looks overlarge and jagged on her petite head. This is not the fearsome night fairy Aurora has always imagined, the one with enough strength and evil to rival Malfleur's. She doesn't know why everyone here says it's so difficult to get to the Queen, and she doesn't know why the locked door came unlocked. But here she is. She draws in a breath. This is it. This is her chance. Belle Kerr, she says, trying frantically to gather her courage to channel Isby's bravery. Why did you create Somei? She stands taller. Your people are suffering. You must release us. Are the cherry tarts ready? I'm sorry? The tarts, the queen hisses. Blood red? They must be red as blood for the visitor. Someone is coming. Someone is coming. Her hands shake, then her clear green eyes lock on to Aurora's. Who are you? She demands with renewed clarity. Why are you here? There was a spinning wheel, Aurora stutters. But I don't know you. You're not the one I'm waiting for. She shakes her head. Everything is wrong. Aurora clears her throat. Just tell me how to get back to the other world. The one you came from. The one we came from. The Queen shakes her head again. I don't know how to make it right. I wish I could, but I can't. Surely you can help? You have greater power than any other living fairy.
The Queen stares back at her again, trembling now.
I'm trapped, too.
Her voice, raspy and low, is unnerving.
But that doesn't make sense. You made this place. Why?
There's a pause. The Queen continues to stare at her in grief, a look that drives through Aurora's chest like one of the deadly sharp icicles that hang from the Delusian gates in winter.
I don't remember.
The Queen's hoarse voice crawls into Aurora's ears, making her shiver. A series of shouts cause Aurora to turn. Through the open door, there's a light bobbing.
Aurora!
It's Ren's voice. Relief floods her.
What are you doing here?
Ren asks urgently as she bursts through the door to the North Hall, carrying a lantern.
I was just...
Aurora turns around, but Belkhir has vanished. She blinks rapidly. Not only is the Queen gone, but there is no other exit to the room. She looks around, despite the dust hanging in the air and the dimness, diminished only a little by the lantern. Aurora sees that the walls are completely bare. All of the tapestries have disappeared. She swallows hard, her head swimming through the murk of the room and the conversation she just had.
Could she have imagined it all?
No. No, Belkhir was here.
There you are. You shouldn't be near the north turret. It's not safe,
Ren says, taking Aurora by the elbow.
The Queen's enchantments are particularly strong here. Many have gone in search of her and never returned. I've told you already. The room's become a maze with no end and no center. I saw her. I saw the Queen,
Aurora says.
Her pearl rolled under the door and unlocked it somehow, and
she trails off, no longer trusting her own impression of what happened. Ren wrinkles her pretty brow as she leads her out of the empty hall.
Heath, we're so worried when you were missing at dinner, and we realized no one had seen you all day,
she says quietly as they wind their way back through the castle. Through the large windows in the east parlor, Aurora sees that night has fallen, but it felt like she'd been in the tapestry room for minutes, not hours.
He said you two had an argument earlier,
Ren goes on.
His moods can sometimes be stormy,
Ren says apologetically.
We've never had an outsider before. None of us knows quite what to believe. Many of the others fear... What do they fear? That you are not real. If not an impression, then some other creation of the Queen's. A trick, an illusion, an enchantment. That I'm not real,
Aurora marvels. Ren squeezes Aurora's hand. The quick pulse reminds Aurora of Isby and sends a lump straight to her throat.
But don't worry. Heath believes you. And I believe you too.
She delivers Aurora to her room.
Thank you, Ren,
Aurora says, still clutching her hand. But despite the young woman's kindness, Aurora has never felt more alone. 16. Isabel.
Far as I can take you, lad.
The stranger who saved Isby from drowning now pats her shoulder with a rough hand as their boat bobs, quietly knocking against a pier. She nods, her mouth dry from salt and vomit.
Honour be with you,
she says, trying to keep her voice masculine and devoid of the polish of nobility. It seems an inadequate phrase, but she's at a loss for words. The man rescued her for no good reason. He asked for nothing in return, only stated with a half-laugh,
I thought you'd were the ghost at the balladeer hisself out there, I did,
as he pulled her aboard. Isby's entire body now screams in stiffness and pain as she wobbles out of the small boat, pulling herself onto the abandoned pier. The immense cold had ceased to bother her for the last hour, but moving has reawakened the bone chill, and she shivers uncontrollably as she sits on the dock, listening to the man row away. She inhales, taking a moment to consider this new depth of aloneness, cool and echoey as a wine cave. She has never been this alone, never without Gilbert's or Aurora's hand to guide her through unknown territory. Or when they weren't there,
She always knew they'd be close by, looking for her. Now the world yawns open around her, a giant blank, a terrifying mystery full of mixed sounds and smells and unpredictable dangers. The air here is fresh and bright, though. A marbled fog constantly stifles the Delusian palace. The maids always complained of the challenge of drying laundry, and Isby grew accustomed to the smell of damp sheets and mildewed brays. But here, she finds herself squinting in the sun. There must be a glare off the water. She listens to the wood licked by the gentle Arbinian waves. Glog, glog, ricket glog. Nothing like the ravenous cush, cash of the Delusian surf against the cliffs. Deluce is a peace-loving nation surrounded by violent breakers, while Arbin, it seems, is a militaristic state hugged by friendly seas. But the friendliness ends at the shore. Isby and her anonymous, gruff-voiced sailor savior had been turned away from three ports already, told that Arbin's borders were closed off to prevent the spread of disease. The country has not only heard of the sleeping sickness, but believes it to be the next in a rash of plagues that have decimated the population over the last few decades. And they aren't taking any chances, especially not on bedraggled riffraff like them. After the third refusal, the sailor decided it was wise to split up and find their own ways past the harbor guards. Isby knows Gil would never even consider leaving her in such a situation. But he has left her, however unwillingly. They never found each other after getting separated during the hunt. She doesn't know if he managed to scramble back aboard the merchant vessel, or if he made it safely to Arbin in one of the smaller dinghies like she has, or... She can't bring herself to think of the third possibility. The screams of the many men who were dislodged from their positions, lost their footing and found their way into the sea, echo in her memory, and Gil was never a particularly good swimmer. If he did make it back onto the larger vessel, they would likely have been turned away at the harbour too, which means they probably would have returned to Deluce to recover. She can only hope that in another day's time, Gilbert will have found his way back to Rule's house. But knowing Gil, he'd make every effort to set out again to find her. And then she remembers something else. Gilbert gambled his luck away to Binks. The thought falls inside her, heavy as a rock. But surely, surely she would know somehow, she would feel it, if Gil had died. Wouldn't she? Her jaw clamps hard, and she runs her hands through her shorn hair, trying to think, or to stop thinking. Stop remembering their fierce, fleeting kiss before he vanished. Stop desperately wondering what it meant. She touches her face, feels the harsh but familiar angles of her cheeks and nose, feels the wetness coming from her eyes, wipes it away. She sucks in a shaky breath. She may never know if Gil is alive or dead, just like the injured narwhal. He has entered an unknowable darkness. However, she reminds herself that if Gil is alive, she can do nothing for him right now but wish and hope. And wishing and hoping don't get results. Action does. She left on a mission, and she's still far from accomplishing it. She pushes herself to standing, feeling her way carefully along the rickety pier with one foot in front of the other. She needs to get to the prince. The stench hits her before she stumbles onto dry land, and it immediately becomes clear why this point of entrance has been left unguarded. Sewage. Isby gags, then tears off part of her sleeve and ties it around her mouth and nose. This must be the narrow waterway that lets Arbin's royal sewage out to sea. No wonder no ships dock here. She walks a little bit taller. The discovery is disgusting, yet convenient. It means she can follow the little inlet straight into the heart of the castle village. There have been many times during Isby's childhood when she questioned her rightful place at the palace, her rightful place anywhere. But Gil often assured her that these distinctions of class are less important than we'd like to believe. "Rich or poor, noble or peasant, everybody shits," he'd say with a laugh. And so, as the day blooms above, doing little to melt the glacier within her, Isby labours along the muddy, rancid shore toward the Arbinian palace and the unknowing prince within it, covering her mouth and clinging to the memory of Gil's laughter like the edges of a warm cloak.
Isby has always enjoyed making her sister laugh. Just days before the report of the prince's murder, she and Aurora were making snow statues in the palace gardens. The air tasted like watered honey, a sure sign that more snow would come. Isby was just putting the finishing touches on a sculpture of Pig, a mutt that had become a favorite of the palace guards.
"You're missing something," Aurora tapped, bending down and quickly patting together a mushy lump of snow, which she placed at Snow Pig's feet.
"What is it?"
Isby asked.
"A pastry you stole from the kitchens, of course." "Let me see yours," Isby demanded.
Aurora guided her over to the sculpture she'd been working on all morning and set Isby's hand on its shoulder. Isby gently felt for the chin and face before running her fingers over the rest of him, taking in the details Aurora had added. It was Prince Philip again. Of course.
"Yours is missing something too," Isby announced,
grabbing a handful of snow off a nearby hedge and patting it into a flat circle like a medallion. She used her fingernail to carve the Arbinian insignia on it, a hawk perched on a sword.
"Show off,"
her sister replied. Aurora had read everything there was to know about the Arbin court, from their favorite fashions to their dining customs to the castle layout itself. She tapped all of this information to Isby, sometimes struggling when the details were too complex for their secret language. The spires on the towers of Arbin's palace, for example, became roof spheres. Now Isby reached up and, before Aurora could stop her, rearranged Prince Philip's face so that his tongue was sticking out. Aurora laughed, and then, out of nowhere, pegged her with a snowball. And that spelled the end for Philip and Pig, as Isby screamed and Aurora laughed, and both got covered in snow until Councilman Maximilian spotted them from a window and ordered them inside. Then, the cold air on her bare hands and cheeks had made Isby feel alive and happy. Now, though, her legs tremble uncontrollably and she falls to the ground, unable to shake the chill from her bones or her mind. She gets onto her hands and knees in the icy mud and sewage and crawls. 17. Malfleur, the last remaining fairy queen. From above, the Lamort territories appear to be on fire. Thick smoke from the underground furnaces hovers over the valley villages, obscuring the bustle and toil of thoroughfares, the icily flowing mountain rivers, and the gnarled black trees common to the region, making it seem instead as though the mountain range, white-capped and tapering into greys and purples, like the belly of a dove, is magically rising out of dark clouds. Malfleur pulls her lynx cloak tighter around her shoulders. The cold is harshest just before dawn. Even after all these years, she still hasn't gotten used to it. She knows the rumors, that the Lamort territories are scattered and disorganized, a patchwork of contentious tribes loosely held together through shared customs and shared fears. They say that the fiefdoms suffer under her iron-fisted rule, due in particular to a lack of young mothers, since so many girls of a certain age are forced to pay their tithe to the queen, after which their youth and beauty shrivel. But from her perch atop the bastion tower of Blackthorn, at the very peak of Mount Briar, Malfleur sees a different picture, a fluid series of gasps and pangs, the coy shape-shifting of the clouds white in the white sky, the suicidal streak of a falcon on the hunt, all silver and light, disappearing into the smoke as though plunging into a shadowed sea, and beneath it all, the hiss of the furnaces. It had been an incredible feat both of magic and invention, a way to make the infertile soils of the steepest slopes pliant, a way to make the harrowing crags and cliffs habitable. Underground kilns that boil water day and night, transforming this once barren region into one that is wet enough to bear life and grow. The idea had come to her from the lips of a bard. He spoke of the burning flame of the heart, its own kind of hell. She had to have him executed for obvious reasons. Words of such beauty can only breed discontent, persuading the people to dream of things they can never have.
His death had nothing to do with the fact that he reminded her of someone. Someone she knew long ago. After having the bard cut in little pieces, she fed him to her white panther to see whether the taste of poetry was bitter or sweet. But the panther told her the man tasted just as all creatures do, like the fear of death. In the end, there'd be nothing left but bones and hair and the lingering effect of his words on her mind. Its own kind of hell. Now her kingdom is prospering like never before, all because of the furnaces, like infernal, burning hearts. But this, of course, is not enough for Malfleur. If anything, the accomplishment tastes ashen and caustic as the air itself. People mistake her. Though her tithe may be youth, it is not vanity that motivates her. What is beauty? Impeccable skin and eyes so blazing dark they make men weep. Without power? No, what Malfleur has sought for more than a century, and what she seeks still, cannot be counted in the heartbreaking arch of an eyebrow or the cat-like dance of bone and muscle across the back. Malfleur has travelled the world, studied the nuances of magic in realms near and far. It is self-evident. Magic is a force of the mind, not the body, and she is still far from perfecting hers. She needs more time, and that is why she continues to tithe youth. But she's getting closer. Her powers are ever increasing. Her army is robust and expanding. Her experiments on human-animal language acquisition are beginning to flourish, though there was a setback a few weeks ago when a large flock of starlings escaped mid-testing in a cloud of terrified flaps and screams. As if in response to this thought, the muzzled albino panther standing beside Malfleur on the stone lookout, the queen's most successful experiment so far, stretches, her fine shoulder blades like miniature mountains that sink back into snow-coloured fur.
"Your day ends as mine begins," Malfleur says to the creature.
She's often thought of training herself to become nocturnal like a leopard or lynx, but she's always loved to sleep in the night. It was one thing she and her sister had in common. Belcur was addicted to dreaming, while Malfleur craves the opposite. The thick, black hours in which her mind and her magic are an undisturbed blank. The panther licks the back of her paw through the straps of her leather muzzle, then turns to the queen.
"Like leaves," she says in a velvet purr.
She lifts her front paws onto the parapet.
"Like leaves in wind, in rain, in fall, in restless. I want river. I want rush. I want..."
"You are hungry, my girl," Malfleur replies.
"I can fix that."
"No, no fix. I am not hungry for flesh. I am hungry for..."
The panther sniffs the air. "I am hungry for..."
"There is still a tower full of pine martens and minks for you."
The panther chuffs, and the queen hears a feral frustration in the sound.
"I am hungry for... hungry for..."
Malfleur looks at the animal's slitted eyes.
"You are hungry for hunger," she corrects, finally understanding.
The creature has grown complacent after days kept by the queen's side.
"I must hunt."
The panther lets out a low, ravenous moan, ripped through with thunder. The sound gives Malfleur a chill, reminding her why she keeps her pet muzzled while at the palace.
"So hunt," Malfleur answers.
"I release you."
"But there is disease," the animal says, licking the back of her other paw, then wiping it across her chin, where the leather binds to its chains.
She is cleaning a thin wound, torn jaggedly along her jawbone.
"I chase. I do not scavenge. You think I am no different than a jackal or a wolf. The world must run from me, not lie in wait. I do not eat. Disease
Disease. The sleeping sickness, the panther says, beginning to pace in a circle. It spreads. It starts with the girl with the sun hair. The princess. But it comes. It comes closer. It ends when we are all fallen. I do not eat rotten fruit fallen from tree. Then I too become rotten flesh. Food for flies. Food for flies. The panther spits the words in a series of guttural hisses. The queen too is disturbed by word of the sleeping sickness. Some of her citizens believe her to be its cause, but she would never claim this disease. Her curse was meant only to kill an otherwise harmless princess. She had nothing against the child. It was what the child represented that bothered her. Yet another human heir to a kingdom that would have been, in her time, fairy-ruled. It was meant to punish the pompous King Henri and his petty wife and the ridiculous council parading about the palace that was once her own family's. It was meant to restore fear to the hearts of complacent Delusians, of the Fae too, who no longer seemed to believe in their own powers or, more importantly, in hers. But she had made a mistake by bringing the spinning wheel into the curse. It was a careless, bitter jab on her part, referring simply to a bad memory from her childhood. Curses have a way of unearthing little needles from the curse's past, and she should have been more careful. And then Violette interfered, like some puffed-up orange ostrich. It is never advisable to amend a curse. Magic does unnerving things when perverted by other magic, even, or perhaps especially, when great magic is impeded and altered by a lesser magic. The princess, Malfleur, is certain, was saved by Violette. In that, she fell asleep and didn't die, but neither the curse nor its amendment should have resulted in a contagion of sleep. She can picture what the panther has seen, fields of once slumbering sheep, now ravaged by wolves, wagon horses and their passengers toppled and snoring themselves to a frozen death at the side of a road. But if the borders are full of such easy prey, she says now to her pet, then how did you come upon that impressive scar?
This,
the wildcat says, arching her neck so that her bloodied cheek catches the just cresting sun.
Came from no animal. It was the claws of the vines.
Claws of the... You mean thorns? Her magic has its limits. She could give the beast the language of a human, but she couldn't make it think like one.
Purple flowers grow around the palace of Deluce. They smell like ladies' mouths. Too sweet. They are spreading. Leaves like mouths hiding fangs. Like mouths.
Here the panther lets out a great yawn, the chains of her muzzle clanging, her own fangs glinting. Malfleur is far too intelligent to believe in coincidences. She squints across her kingdom, and the ripples of dark smoke against the bright sky become inked words on the fine vellum pages of a storybook. The caw of the hunting falcon becomes the call of a girl's voice from another room. She's in the small cottage where they used to summer a century ago now.
Don't start it without me,
her twin sister cries, even though they have read the book every night since she can remember. They are getting too old for stories. She flips to the back and sees that Belle Kerr has placed violets, their mother's favorite, in between the pages to press and dry. She fingers them, and they turn to dust in her palm. Malfleur blinks, and the childhood memory too turns to ash, blown away on the wind. It cannot be. Her sister cannot have returned after all these years. But the lush purple flowers, the thorn-ridden vines, the stories of a sleep so deep it cannot be penetrated, these tell a different story, and Malfleur shudders. She'd never wanted her sister to die. She'd wanted her to live and suffer, the way she had for so many years. But maybe she should have killed her when she could. Malfleur knows that timing is everything. It cannot be coincidence that a way into and out of Sommeil has apparently surfaced, causing those vines to leak out at the very same time that her curse on the Delusian princess took effect. The irony is like the sting of a hornet. It smarts and swells and worsens. This is the danger of a fairy curse. Once loosed into the world, a curse will find its way into being. But how it does its work is a mystery, even to the curser. It knits events together, invisibly. The spinning wheel. The symbol Malfleur had chosen to represent her twin's betrayal, and upon which her curse was based. Could it be, all this time, that the spindle contained its own power? Had Belcur enchanted it and left behind that final symbol as a way back? Well, if the Night Fairy is rising, the Queen knows what she must do. She must march, before the disease spreads any further, before her sister's power can corrupt her own. For, as far as Malfleur sees it, only one of them may exist in this world. My pet, the Queen says, I have another job for you. But the creature does not reply. Beside her, the white panther has curled into herself, her breath coming in bursts of white steam against the black of the muzzle. She is asleep. 18. Isabel. Coughing and sputtering, Isby finally reaches an opening in the village walls that rises just inches over the freezing, wretched water, letting air whistle through and beneath it. She doesn't know how long she's been travelling, mostly on all fours along the sewage route. The castle village is farther inland than she thought. It's been more than a full day, and there's a dull burn in her stomach and throat. Holding her breath, she goes under. She emerges on the other side of the wall and gags. Then she crawls along the inside of the wall, away from the stream, until she finds a frozen puddle. She pulls back her hand and then, with a trembling fist, slams hard into the puddle, cracking its surface. Beneath it is clean rainwater, which she hungrily splashes over her face, gulping handfuls of it down until she can no longer take the added injury of cold on cold. Her legs are so chilled she's not sure if she can stand again, but she manages to wobble to her feet. Now that she's moved several yards from the stream, she is able to take in other smells beyond its putrid odour. She detects the smoke of a blacksmith and fumbles toward it, leaving the safety of the wall. All she can think of right now is fire, warmth. Day has fully broken, and she can hear the bustle of peasants pushing carts and herding animals. Someone is bound to spot her soon and realize she is out of place. Several times she trips and falls. On a wooden crate, a low stone wall, other items she's too distressed to recognize. She's too numb to feel the pain of blooming bruises along her shins and arms. A rooster crows at her. She bangs her fists along the outer walls of the blacksmith's shop until she finds the door, a sour burning smell puffing out from its corners. The door swings open, and she falls forward into the smoke and heat.
"He's not dead,"
a young boy exclaims sometime later. For a moment, Isby is sure it's Piers, Gil's nephew. But as she comes to, she realizes the voice bears a distinctly Arbinian accent. That's right. She found the blacksmith's hut. This must be the smith's son.
"But he can't see me,"
the boy adds. Another boy comes over.
"He's got a demon of some kind. Let's get da."
"Wait, no," Isby says, sitting up dizzily on the dirt floor. It's not the first time someone has seen the way her eyes wander, sightless, and believed her to be possessed by an evil spirit. "Don't go to your father, think, Isby. She recalls the stories Gil and Rule used to love to scare her with when they were kids. "I'm a messenger from across the sea. I have news of..." She lowers her voice to a whisper. "The murder of the princes. I got business with the palace, but a pirate, here, took my ship. Now I need you boys' help."
"You see pirates?"
one of them hollers.
"How can we help?"
asks the other.
"Was them princes killed by the pirates too?"
asks the first. "Shh," Isby says, doing her best to seem conspiratorial.
"Them pirates could come back for us."
For us? One of the boys, he can hardly be older than 5 or 6, begins to whimper. She turns to face the older-sounding one. I just need 2 things. First is a cloak. Have you got a clean cloak for me?
He darts away and returns, placing a heavy woolen blanket into her palms.
This will do, Isby says, wrapping it around her shoulders. What's the other thing?
The younger boy asks.
Hand me a stick or a fork, anything like that, and I'll show you, Isby says.
One of the boys places a rustic tool into her hands. She's not sure what it is. She bends over and tries to draw in the hard dirt of the floor, carving the image from memory. The castle's main gates are at the eastern wall. The tallest tower is the northeast one, which overlooks the sea in the distance. And the servants' quarters are clustered along the northernmost wing, which gets the harshest winds and is thus less coveted by the royal family and its guests. She points to a notch she has just drawn in that wall.
I need you to take me here, in secret.
She lets the boys study the messy drawing in the dirt for a full minute or two before rubbing it away with her sleeve.
Will you tell us more about the pirates?
Yes, sir,
Isby promises. I'll tell you all about them. On the way.
Shimmying through the peasant's pantry window is not the hard part, though the main gates to the palace are well protected. The peasant's pantry is easily accessible from the outside. It would not be fitting for farmers to have to deliver grain from the granary to the kitchens via the front entrance, which is reserved for militia, merchants, and visiting nobility. And of course, there's no way she'd pass for any of the above. She has to hide behind a sack of wheat for the better part of the day, knowing the palace is heavily guarded, and that sneaking about in full light is a bad idea. She remains curled in the blacksmith's wool blanket, trying to warm up. Weary as her body feels, she's far too nervous to sleep. But navigating the northern wing and finding passage to the palace wall, walks along the roof that evening is not the hard part either. By testing, listening, and pausing, she is able to make her way to the turret she recalls from her snow sculpting sessions with her sister. This is far safer than wandering the halls themselves, where she's bound to knock over something fragile, creating a distraction, or walk straight into a servant who might report her to the guards. No, the hard part is guessing which of the chambers belongs to the youngest prince. At the news of his elder 2 brothers' deaths, would William have moved up into their likely more plush and comfortable rooms, or remained in his own? She knows that royals are always considering such advantages and what they signify. Then again, Arbyn is not as enamoured of luxuries as the Luces. The Arbynians are known for being a more austere people. How she wishes she were with Gil, and that they were entering the castle the way they'd initially planned, as merchants offering goods to the master of trade. How she wishes, for that matter, that Aurora had never fallen sick with sleep. How she wishes, above all, that the fairies were not such a vengeful and self-serving breed, because it is Binx's fault that Gil and Isby have been separated. She's certain. It's Violette's fault she lost her sight at the age of 2, and it's Malfleur's fault that a curse was put on Aurora in the first place. But wishing, she reminds herself, does not produce results. Her arms shaking from exhaustion, she scampers down over the edge of the parapet and finds footing. Quickly, before she can think how foolishly dangerous this is, she inches along the wall until her foot hits an oriel. The window doesn't open easily. It takes several kicks before she is able to enter with a loud, shattering crack. She almost loses her grip and gasps. The wool blanket falls from her shoulders into the open wind. Then she swings herself the rest of the way through the broken glass and into the room. She catches her breath. Thankfully, no one else seems to be in the room at the moment, or surely there would be hollering, and she'd have been apprehended by now and dragged to the dungeons. She has thrown caution away as easily as she lost her borrowed cloak, and by this point she's hardly even thinking straight. Isby realizes her hand is bleeding, but there's no time to worry. She gropes for something to hold on to. The room must be sparsely appointed, as it is difficult to find anything. She ends up yanking a drape off a large chair in the process, probably leaving a bloody handprint. This must be Edward's or Phillips's room. Why else would the furniture be covered? She crashes into a table next, banging her hip hard. This is a disaster.
In her hurry to find the door, she smashes an object that sounds valuable as it breaks. A servant is bound to have heard. She can only have a few seconds left before someone discovers her. Ah, the door. She exits and runs her hands along walls oddly bare of tapestries.